I'm going to talk about the mid and late 19th century in general, because this is when things really began to happen up here. One of the first things that happened was the economy was changed from that of a subsistence way of life to a dependence partially upon cash and the introduction of trade goods. In exchange for Alaskan products, which of course in the early days were mainly fur, the whites over a period of years introduced firearms, iron, steel, matches, sheet copper, beads, blankets, clocks, Western foods, tea, coffee, sugar, salt, whaling bombs, compasses, clothing, kettles, needles, china dishes. I'm going to talk about the mid and late 19th century in general, because this is when things really began to happen up here. One of the first things that happened was the economy was changed from that of a subsistence way of life to a dependence partially upon cash and the introduction of trade goods. In exchange for Alaskan products, which of course in the early days were mainly fur, the whites over a period of years introduced firearms, iron, steel, matches, sheet copper, beads, blankets, clocks, Western foods, tea, coffee, sugar, salt, whaling bombs, compasses, clothing, kettles, needles, china dishes, metal cookingware, rope, alcohol, and many other objects. While some of these objects were used as Europeans would, like firearms, matches, and compasses, other items such as alcohol were imported and introduced without their Western social context. The whalers and Russians and so forth didn't sip liqueurs after dinner or drink fine whiskey. They drank the worst kind of rot gut, and they drank to get drunk. And with this example, the natives felt that this was obviously the way one coped with this particular type of product. On the other hand, many objects were imported and were used by the natives in their own particular way, and there were a great number of these taking of a Western product and turning it into something uniquely their own. For example, blankets and pearl buttons were brought into southeastern Alaska, and the Indians in southeastern didn't use them just for sleeping. They used them in conjunction with the buttons to make ceremonial costumes which combined traditional designs with items of Western manufacture, producing something that was uniquely Tlingit. And these examples are almost endless. Dental floss is another. It's used all over Alaska as a very adequate sewing material. And of course, everybody knows all the different things that you can do with oil drums. You can produce all sorts of practical things with them. And the natives showed a great deal of ingenuity in thinking up new and better and more adaptive ways of using many of these products. Trade between the natives and the whites moved slowly from a barter situation to a time in which certain amounts of furs were equivalent to certain amounts of trade goods, to the gradual growth and spread of cash, with generally fixed prices for almost everything. Now, as I said, this is a great generalization. Some of these things happened much earlier in different parts of Alaska. And of course, the closer that the natives were to a particular white town or white area, the more they became involved in the cash economy. Some stores and companies introduced the use of tokens in exchange for native products. And these were generally redeemable only at the stores of that company. So you had sort of a captive trade audience. Many stores also extended credit, and some natives found themselves in perpetual debt to store owners. As more and more whites entered Alaska, cash or its equivalent in gold became generally the medium of exchange. Natives had a variety of opportunities to earn cash, the opportunities, of course, being greater the closer they were to white areas and communities. The Russians had trained clerks and accountants and so forth, as I mentioned before. The schools introduced manual training, home economics, and many other things. There were also many people who worked in part-time or for part-time jobs or for jobs that just took a period of time, like a couple of years on a whaling ship or something. They worked as cooks, hunters, skin sewers, whalers, commercial fishermen, nurses, cutting wood for steamboats, ivory carvers, laundresses, blacksmiths, and many, many other occupations. However, most of these people, because they did have just part-time jobs or even no job, were still dependent on a subsistence way of life or a combination of subsistence and cash economy. Becoming involved in a partially existing cash economy meant that most of the economic life of Alaska Natives was dependent upon the fluctuation of world markets, such as that of the fur markets, and when it crashed, they suffered quite often without knowing why. And of course, any kind of depression in the rest of the world was, of course, felt even more so in Alaska. And of course, when prices went up outside, they went up much, much higher up here, as they still do. Now, another effect is one that's not often thought about, but it's occasionally mentioned, and that's the concept of time. The average American is obsessed with time. Our lives are regulated by clocks, watches, calendars, work hours, appointments, meetings, and looking forward to retirement. And this has been true for many, many years. On the other hand, the world of the Alaskan Natives was regulated by the changing seasons, the weather, and the movements of birds, animals, and fish. This bred an enormous amount of patience and a willingness to work very, very hard for an immediate reward, such as in hunting. Since life was hard and it was chancy, they saw no virtue in worrying about the distant future when survival demanded that they concentrate on the here and the now. And these two opposing views of time have clashed many times in Alaska, and no doubt will continue to do so for some time. Another factor that had a tremendous effect on the native peoples in Alaska was disease. In fact, someone has once said that you could say the American Aborigines were conquered neither by the sword nor by the cross, but by disease. When the first Europeans arrived, they brought a number of diseases with them, with which the Alaska Natives were not familiar, and hence they had little or no resistance. Entire populations were, in certain areas, were decimated in the periodic unchecked epidemics, that swept Alaska up until the 20th century. Survivors of epidemics were forced to band together into new villages, usually built around a trading post and later on around schools and missions. This was sort of the beginning of the consolidation of native groups into larger and fairly permanent villages in most areas. Missionaries established a number of homes for orphans in which the children were taken in and provided for, and of course they were also educated and trained in many of the white man's ways. The Russians introduced smallpox vaccination into the areas of Alaska that were under their control, but this was done primarily to protect their workforce rather than from any purely humanitarian motives. When the Russians arrived in southeastern Alaska, they, of course, wished to convert the Tlingit to Christianity, and the Tlingit, observing the Aleuts, who were Christians and slaves of the Russians, said, "No, thank you, we're not interested." In 1836, there was a smallpox epidemic that swept the area near Sitka. The Tlingit observed that the Russians and the Aleuts were not affected because, of course, they had been vaccinated. And the Tlingit finally asked for help, and after that, as Veniaminov notes, they were much more receptive to the introduction of Christianity. After Western medicine and sanitary practices were introduced into Alaska, the death rate among the natives began to fall dramatically, and the birth rate began to rise equally dramatically. And this in turn, of course, led to its own set of economic problems. It's much more difficult to support 12 children than it is to support the two that, or three that might have survived in the past. Certain practices introduced by Americans as being totally progressive often had hidden traps in them. For example, the building of frame houses was encouraged in most parts of Alaska. It was the proper thing to do. Many of these houses, however, especially in the Arctic area, were flimsy and drafty, and you had to have the stove red hot all the time, and this lowered the humidity and it made the spread of respiratory diseases much more rapid. Another factor that shouldn't be forgotten is intermarriage. Many white men who settled in Alaska married Native women, and these men were a very powerful force in the acculturation process, or the accustoming, helping people to cope with a new way of life. They could explain the white man's ideas, concepts, and laws to their families and relatives. They encouraged their children to go to school. Their children had a head start in learning English and adapting to a new way of life. In other words, these men were buffers, in effect, between the two different cultures. Many families combined the best of both cultures. And there were also individuals in the different cultures who met as equals, with each learning from the others. You can learn more from a friend in a different culture than you can ever learn from any amount of textbooks and talks and so forth, as we all know. Marshall's book, Arctic Village, is a good example of a small face-to-face society in which members of different cultures respected and liked each other and got along very well indeed. Another factor in white native relations was the introduction of a different, a more remote, and a more impersonal form of government. By the late 19th century, most Alaskan natives found that they no longer set and enforced all the standards of daily life. New concepts, new laws, new system of rewards and punishments had been introduced and imposed by members of the dominant culture. Laws generally came from mysterious figures in Washington, D.C., many of whom, unhappily, had never set foot in Alaska. But fortunately, most of the white authority figures in Alaska, the teachers, missionaries, government agents, and marshals, were a lot more realistic and practical in interpreting and applying the law. In the past, offenders within a particular native group were punished within the group by means of ridicule, gossip, both of which are still very important factors of social control, just as they are in any small face-to-face society. They could ostracize people, they could banish them, or they could use force, as in the case of murder. In most Alaskan groups, murderers were usually killed by a member of the victim's family. And in some cases, this ended the problem. In other cases, family feuds could develop. Although in some cases, a man might be considered so dangerous to the whole group that the entire village would rise against him. The white man's laws often seemed arbitrary and confusing to people used to solving problems in a face-to-face situation in their own manner. But they seemed even more so when the natives observed that there were often two standards of justice, one for the white man and one for the natives. Having noted this, they very sensibly never bothered to report many offenses. And they handled these matters in a traditional manner in the village. I'm not saying everyone did this all the time, but it did happen. Alaskan or American Indians and Eskimos were not full citizens of the United States until 1924. But previous to that time, under the laws or the provisions of the Dawes Act or Allotment Act, which was set up in 1887, a Indian or Eskimo who was, quote, living a civilized life, unquote, could apply to the courts for full citizenship. And if he did indeed convince the court that he was, quote, civilized, unquote, he would then become a full citizen with the right to vote and so forth. The last topic I'd like to say something about is formal education and the introduction of Christianity. You can't divide these two topics because early missionaries provided the teaching staff in Alaska. First, I'd like to say something about the native methods of education. In non-literate societies, watching, listening, and doing are the major ways of learning. The children watch their parents do things, listen to their parents discuss things, heard stories and myths and explanations from their grandparents and other elders. They were given miniature adult tools and weapons that they could practice with, because someday their lives would depend upon the use of these things. Little girls learned to sew clothes for their dolls as they would later for their husbands and children. Young children were indulged and enjoyed, and when they reached the age of 8 or 9 or 10, they were then expected to start beginning to leave childish ways behind and become incorporated into the adult society around them. Games were also a very important method of learning and training. All of the Alaska Native groups had a great variety of competitive games, tests of strength, tests of endurance. We can still see many of these at the Eskimo Olympics every year, where they're so ably demonstrated. Children were generally encouraged to improve their own skills rather than to compete directly with others, especially among the Eskimo. This caused some problems in the classroom, where children are encouraged to compete against each other. When a child made his first kill, or a little girl brought home her first basket of berries, most Native groups made quite a fuss over the child. They were now considered to be ready to begin contributing to the group. One of the most important things that the Native groups did was to emphasize the positive and ignore the first few mistakes that you made. Several years ago, I was in a kitchen in an Eskimo village in northwestern Alaska, and the six-year-old daughter of the house tottered in with a full bucket of water, most of which, of course, she spilled because she was a very little girl and it was a very big bucket. Most white parents that I'm acquainted with would have pointed out that the water was on the floor, this was not the way to do it, and you really shouldn't mess around with such things. The father of this little girl said, "Thank you very much for bringing in the water." And he didn't mention the negative aspects, like the water all over the floor. This is one place, I think, where the white people could learn from the natives to encourage the positive instead of harping on the negative all the time in the education of their children. Religion among the native peoples is an enormous topic, and of course what I'm going to say about it is quite general and quite superficial. In general, the native people of Alaska felt that everything animate and inanimate in the world had its own spirit. People had spirits which could be entrapped or bewitched by evil spirits, or in southeastern Alaska, by witches. And the shamans, or the, quote, medicine men, unquote, were the buffers between the real world of suffering and troubles and the spirit world. All groups in Alaska had a variety of customs and ceremonies and beliefs that had to be carried out to protect people and to ensure the renewal of the food supply. Most of the ceremonies in Alaska did revolve about this renewal of the food supply, because of course this was a tremendously important topic to them. In southeastern Alaska, there were a bigger variety of ceremonies, many of which had to do with the redistribution of property. Formal education was introduced, as I said before, by the Russians, and it was primarily to benefit the Russians, to provide clerks and workers for their company. It was not a general type of education. Although we must give the Russians credit for a period after the purchase of Alaska by the United States, the Russians were the only people providing any kind of education in Alaska. And this was noted by Governor Swinford, who was territorial governor in 1887. He pointed out to the Secretary of the Interior that the despotic Russians spent over $60,000 a year maintaining schools, and the, quote, free, liberal, and enlightened United States provided absolutely nothing. And this was 20 years after the purchase. After the purchase of Alaska, the Russians withdrew some of their teachers, which were not replaced by the Americans. But in general, Russian education in Alaska lasted from 1785, when a school was established at Three Saints Bay in Kodiak, to 1916, when a girls' boarding home closed in Kodiak. The Russians did not bother too much about worrying about what the Americans thought. They just kept right on with their schools. During the early American period, some very interesting things happened. During the administration of President Ulysses Grant, the control and education of the American Indian tribes was taken out of the hands of the military and given to various religious denominations within the United States. In other words, the Presbyterians got this area, the Catholics got that area, the Quakers got this area, and so forth. And this held true also in Alaska to some extent. It's impossible to discuss education in Alaska without talking about Sheldon Jackson, who came here in the late 19th century as a Presbyterian missionary. He was very upset about the lack of educational facilities in Alaska, and through letters and petitions and public lectures outside, he finally spurred enough interest in Alaskan education to help in the passage of the Organic Act, which provided for local rule in Alaska, and it also made provisions for education for both white and native children. The Presbyterians arrived in Alaska in 1877. The Moravians came into the Bethel area in 1885. The Roman Catholics came in 1888. There were also Protestant, Episcopalian, and Methodist Episcopal schools and churches, and the Friends and the Swedish Evangelical Church were also represented here then. By 1888, there were 13 government schools, two schools still maintained by the Alaska Commercial Company, 17 Russian schools, and 11 schools maintained and supported by other denominations. I'm sorry, I think I said 1887. The Harrison Bill was passed in 1884, and that, among other things, provided that there be local school boards be set up, that there be commissioner of education, and that Alaskans could now begin to take a hand in the education of their own children. This was an absolutely staggering job. We're all aware of the distances in Alaska, the climate. Transportation at that time was by boat, by dog sled, by river, and it all took a great deal of time. Teachers that came to Alaska had to be expected to put up with isolation. They might be in a village where they were the only English speakers. They got supplies once or twice a year. They were expected to do a tremendous number of things. They had to oversee sanitary improvements in the village. They had to teach English, reading, writing, arithmetic, democracy, hygiene, cooking. Many of the women teachers found themselves teaching shop because there was no male teacher available. They were also expected to do all the paperwork concerning the village in areas in which there were reindeer. They were expected to act as overseers to the reindeer herders, even if they had never seen a reindeer before. Fortunately, Alaska was and has been quite lucky in getting a lot of high caliber teachers. Every profession, however, has its less fortunate practitioners, shall we say. And unfortunately, some of these teachers succeeded only in embittering the local natives by their high-handed methods and their ideas that, you know, all this must go and everything must be done in a different way. The teachers were also handicapped by poor textbooks. These were all written for children living outside of Alaska. However, they did at that time in some schools use the idea that you cannot teach English to non-English speakers the same way in which you can teach it to native speakers of the language or people whose mother tongue is English. And of course, the university is currently involved in a program of this type whereby children will learn to read and write in their own language first and then go on to English. In 1885, Dr. Jackson was appointed the general agent of education in Alaska. And at this time, contracts were let to missions to run various of the schools in Alaska. In other words, the missions provided the teachers, and the state, or rather the territory, provided the money, the pay, and the maintenance of the school, and so forth. Most villages were, frankly, eager for education, for schools. They soon realized that they needed special training to cope with the white man's world that had suddenly appeared around them. And most children were very eager to go to school. One of the biggest problems in early Alaskan education, which has unfortunately lasted to the present day, is the having to send children outside of Alaska for a higher education. This removed children from their homes at a very important stage of their development. They were sent to a completely foreign environment where they spoke a foreign language. In fact, children were often punished, sometimes quite brutally, for speaking anything other than English in these schools. The children were often kept away from home for several years. For example, some Eskimo and Indian children were sent to Carlisle, Jim Thorpe's old school in Pennsylvania, and they might be kept there for 4, 5, or 6 years. And when they came back, they had a terrific adjustment to make. Some of them didn't make the adjustment. They left the village. And others changed. Others were forever unhappy, marginal people who never fit in either culture. On the other hand, there were a lot of children who did tremendously well and managed to combine the best aspects of both worlds. The general effects of Western education and Christianity included the development of feelings of inferiority among the natives in many aspects. Many missionaries told them that their ways were totally wrong, their beliefs were ignorant, their ideas about things were all wrong. And since the white man obviously had such a fantastic technology at his disposal, some natives felt that he also had command of the spiritual realm as well. Native people were forced to give up dancing, various ceremonies, and all sorts of things that were totally a part of the tradition. The last thing that I have to say is a little quote from the 1908 report to the Commissioner of Education. It's a quote from a teacher at Wainwright, Alaska. And this young man came to Alaska with all sorts of ideas about how he was going to change things. But after a year in the village, he said, "Many of the finely spun idealisms with which I began my work here are sadly shattered idols now. The Arctic is a stern iconoclast. Our most cherished dreams, as well as our most complicated theories, well enough fitted to live in the Southland, shrivel and die in the Arctic solitude. I have become firmly convinced that civilization cannot be grafted upon these people, that it can only come about by accepting the good that we find in native society, and while cherishing that, lead on to other things, and that we should be very slow in advising the natives to abandon the customs, ethics, and inventions that the adaptions and adjustments of thousands of years have often made much more serviceable than are those which we would put in."